Hello, everybody. Time for a change in pace here. We're going to talk about something completely different. We're going to talk about schizophrenia, where we are headed, advancements in the treatment of schizophrenia. I'm going to do it all in 35 minutes. Is this even possible? Well, we'll see. I want to leave some time for Q&A, of course. All right. We're going to explore evolving hypotheses on the neurobiology and treatment of schizophrenia. That'll be our main focus in terms of getting a broad overview of how antipsychotics or drugs that work in schizophrenia can evolve. We're going to implement novel and existing treatments for schizophrenia based on both efficacy and tolerability. I'm going to address the tolerability part. I'm also going to address adherence to a little bit, talk about long-acting injectables, what's new in that domain. So can we treat psychosis without directly blocking dopamine receptors? I think we can. Do we have new solutions for side effects? Yes, we do. Can we improve adherence? Yes, we can. And we're going to review all the new agents in the pipeline that are in phase 3, as well as agents that are kind of new that we have we can use like tomorrow if we so desire. So can we treat psychosis without directly blocking dopamine receptors? Let me review with you stuff you already know about the dopamine theory of schizophrenia, hyperactive dopamine at D2 receptors in the mesolimbic pathway explains hallucinations and delusions. But there's also a glutamate theory that we've been talking about for some time now about NMDA receptor hypofunction, which downstream perhaps leads to hyperactive dopamine at D2 receptors in the mesolimbic pathway, but we can perhaps target the glutamate receptor and achieve what we need to achieve. There's also the serotonin theory of schizophrenia, where we can see in the brains of people 5-HT2A receptor hyperfunction in the cortex, which ultimately also leads to increasing dopamine in the mesolimbic pathway. So all roads lead to dopamine, but they get there in different ways. We can block dopamine receptors directly and treat psychotic symptoms. That's what we've done for 70 years. All the currently available antipsychotics approved by the FDA work in this manner. They all bind to postsynaptic D2 receptors in the ventral striatum, and by doing so, reduce hallucinations and delusions. But we can also modulate the glutamatergic pathway and hence modulate dopamine. In theory, yes. In reality, NMDA and other glutamate receptor modulators have failed so far in clinical trials for the treatment of schizophrenia, but that's not stopping anyone from thinking about this and trying to develop new ways of addressing this. We can also antagonize serotonin 5-HT2A receptors, ultimately leading to amelioration of psychotic symptoms. Almost all second-generation antipsychotics antagonize serotonin 5-HT2A receptors. That helps. And with some D2 receptor antagonism, that does the trick, and they're better tolerated than first-generation antipsychotics, which mostly just bind to D2 receptors in terms of efficacy targets. Now, pimavanserin is a 5-HT2A, 5-HT2C antagonist inverse agonist. What's an inverse agonist? Well, an antagonist, you know, sits in the receptor and blocks it. An inverse agonist sits in the receptor and renders it completely inoperative. So it shuts it down. It's used to treat Parkinson's disease psychosis today. It's also been studied to treat dementia-related psychosis and perhaps can treat negative symptoms of schizophrenia. There's a paper coming out in the not too distant future of a phase 2 trial that looked at this, authored by Henry Nasrallah and Celso Rango as the external authors, from a clinical trial done by Acadia. Well, let's take a look down the roads less traveled. All roads lead to dopamine, but there are some roads that have been less traveled. So trace amine-associated receptors. It's a whole new ball game here. TAR. So I feel like it's talk like a pirate day today with TAR. Hey, ahoy, mateys, let's talk about TAR. That's what's run through my mind when I see this. It may now be indelibly etched in yours as well. So trace amine receptors, associated receptors, are predominantly intracellular receptors that modulate neurotransmission in monoaminergic neurons, including dopaminergic neurons, including serotonergic neurons. There are pre- and postsynaptic effects, and there's crosstalk between dopamine and TAR1 systems. It's complex, not fully understood. Here's a diagram of some of what's going on. Now, Dr. Stahl is going to do a whole TAR presentation tomorrow for you, and maybe you can get him to talk like a pirate. It's a lot of fun. Just say, Dr. Stahl, can you talk like a pirate? And he may accommodate your desires. Anyhow, TAR1 agonists have been studied in schizophrenia. Ulotaront, CEP363856, is an agonist at TAR1 receptors. It also has affinity at 5-HT1A receptors, which may be quite important. And all this is very nice conceptually, but the proof of the pudding is in the tasting, correct? So a phase 2 trial was conducted, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled. It lasted 4 weeks. Flexibly dosed ulotaront, 50 or 75 milligrams, was compared with placebo in people with an acute exacerbation of their schizophrenia. Now, it was a younger population with a limited number of hospitalizations in order to, okay, let's see if this really works in an enriched population that should benefit, you know, see a difference between drug and placebo the best we can. And in fact, CEP363856 separated from placebo on the positive and negative syndrome total score. That's great. But what about positive symptoms, negative symptoms, general psychopathology? It turns out when you go to the subscales that the effect size for negative symptoms was actually larger than the effect size for positive symptoms, although they were pretty close. But that's an interesting signal for a 4-week clinical trial. And the adverse event profile seemed relatively benign. If you look at the actual adverse event rates, they're small. They're similar to that seen with placebo. There is no drug-induced Parkinsonism. There is no metabolic parameter that's different from what was seen with placebo. This is actually quite exciting. And so it is in phase 3, a road less traveled. We'll hear more about it. There are other TAR1 agonists also being investigated. They're in phase 2, though. This one is now in phase 3. Another road less traveled is muscarinic modulation of dopamine. And this also influences glutamate, too. So this is actually pretty complex. And a big challenge was finding a muscarinic modulation that would be reasonably well tolerated, because as you know, if you muck around with this neurotransmitter system, you would get GI symptoms that make these drugs not very tolerable. But theoretically, this should work. So M2, M3 receptors are the bad ones in terms of major issues with dose-limiting clinical side effects. M1, M4 are the good guys, and if we can only agonize or excite M1, M4 receptors located in the brain, downstream effects will actually lead to a decrease in dopamine in the pathway from the ventral tegmental area to the ventral striatum of our brains and perhaps decrease hallucinations and delusions. Now, xanomeline is a M1, M4 agonist and was studied years ago and demonstrated improvements in the brief psychiatric rating scale and the positive negative syndrome scale scores in patients with schizophrenia. But the GI side effects made it impossible to use. Now, the clever people at Karuna figured out you can combine it with trospium. Trospium is a muscarinic receptor antagonist that does not cross the blood-brain barrier. So you could block these GI side effects that would otherwise xanomeline would be plagued with. So xanomeline-trospium combination. This was tested in a 5-week double-blind placebo-controlled trial, also demonstrated an improvement in the positive negative syndrome scale total score versus placebo. There was some GI side effects, but clearly not the same degree as you would see with xanomeline alone. Now, for both ulotaront, the CEP356 compound, and xanomeline trospium, these phase 2 studies were published in the New England Journal of Medicine, a journal not really known to publish much in the way of psychiatric clinical trials, but they published these two roads less well traveled, because they present a different opportunity to treat schizophrenia without blocking postsynaptic D2 receptors in the ventral striatum. Well, that's really cool, because we haven't had that possibility in 70 years. Now, there's another road sort of well-traveled and didn't work out all that great, and that's glycine transporter 1 inhibition. Years ago, there was the development of bitopertin, which did just that, didn't really work out. But theoretically, by augmenting hypofunctioning NMDA receptors, by making glycine more available to those receptors, you kind of increase the activity of these receptors, and downstream, you would have effects perhaps on improving dopaminergic neurotransmission in the cortex. The people with schizophrenia have insufficient dopamine in the cortex, either the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex regarding cognition or ventral medial prefrontal cortex relating to affect and negative symptoms. So this is curious about schizophrenia. You've heard this before. Too much dopamine in one place in the brain, too little in the other. So glycine T1 inhibition makes these NMDA receptors work better. NMDA receptors need glycine in order to operate. Now we can do that. We can increase glycine at that synapse, at that receptor. So in terms of, does this really work? A phase 2 trial was done with a product called BI, Boehringer Ingelheim, 425809. Doesn't have a name yet. This was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled add-on study of oral BI 425809 at various doses for 12 weeks in stable patients with schizophrenia. And at the higher doses, it improved cognition. Well, that's interesting. Generally well-tolerated. And the only concern here, as with all glycine T1 inhibitors, you're going to look at hemoglobin for dose-related reductions of that. But otherwise, hey, looks pretty promising. This, too, is in phase 3. A road sort of well-traveled, but being traveled again. Let's see if we can make an impact in the care of our patients with schizophrenia through a whole complete different mechanism of action. So that's the new stuff in phase 3, and we look forward to how those studies read out in the next year or two. Now, a road well-traveled is dopamine receptor antagonism, but there's a twist to their story with lumateperone. Lumateperone was approved in December of 2019, and it has actually a 60-fold higher affinity to serotonin 5-HT2A receptors than it does to dopamine D2 receptors. This is really unusual. Very modest levels of dopamine receptor occupancy, 30 to 40%. This is the lowest amongst all the agents in that multiple choice question that I showed you earlier. This is the correct answer. So when I show you the post-test, 100% of you will answer it correctly. You already got that first question correct. Well, it's an interesting agent. Clinical trials demonstrated efficacy in the treatment of patients with acute exacerbation of schizophrenia. 2 out of 3 trials demonstrated this. There is one dose, 42 milligrams once daily, with food, no titration. Very favorable safety profile. So no difference from placebo in weight gain. No difference from placebo, really, in acute extrapyramidal symptoms, including akathisia. There is a higher rate of somnolence or sedation, 24% with lumateperone and 10% for placebo when administered in the morning. And so now the thought is, well, what if we administer it in the evening? Well, your experience will be different. So this is a road well-traveled, but it's a twist to the story, isn't it? Now, there's some roads that were taken that led to nowhere. Now, it doesn't mean that they won't be taken again, but right now, phosphodiesterase 10A inhibition, well, I don't know. It really hasn't worked out. Sigma 2, 5-HT2A antagonism hasn't really worked out all that great. DAAO inhibition, alpha-7 nicotinic acetylcholine receptor modulation, and cannabinoid receptor antagonism. You'll still read about this. There's nothing really now that's terribly encouraging. Now, this may all change. You know, the data is accumulating rapidly, but okay, may need to know where. So that is what's new in terms of molecular compounds. What about a focus on side effects? Because this is where really it's an issue in our day-to-day practice and treating people with schizophrenia and other disorders. Well, we'll use antipsychotics. In a study of close to 2,000 people with psychosis, About 80% reported medication side effects, but about 60% actually reported impairment because of these side effects. And roughly 1 out of 3 reported moderate or severe impairment in their daily life as a result of these medication side effects. Side effects can be disabling, markedly affect quality of life, and if not addressed early, can cause long-term distress, as you know, contribute to chronic healthcare complications. The bottom bullet here, small shifts in functional status can have a marked effect on quality of life. I've lived this with side effects from capecitabine. Who here knows about capecitabine? Capecitabine, it's a 5-FU prodrug. It's very aptly named. It's a chemotherapeutic agent. It causes hand-foot syndrome, and I had it bad when I was receiving chemotherapy about 2 years ago. And I couldn't walk, and so the capecitabine was reduced, and I still had the side effect, but I was able to walk again. So a small shift there in the hand-foot syndrome, much different quality of life. So I really appreciate this on a very visceral level. Now, we have actually suboptimal choices today because of the agents are kind of limited. There was a study that I participated in looking at different segments of adverse event buckets, so to speak. There was a cardiovascular bucket, there was a prolactin elevation bucket, there was a sedation bucket, and an EPS akathisia bucket. And we know that some agents have a greater propensity to cause a problem in one of those 4 categories. And it turns out that the proportion of patients with schizophrenia who actually have these problems is quite high. So we know we have a problem here because the tolerable treatment options in the case of someone having these side effect sensitivities, we don't have many choices. For someone who, let's say, has a cardiovascular issue, in the old days, prior to the availability of brexpiprazole, cariprazine, or lumateperone, we only had 4 options. So aripiprazole, lisinopril, lurasidone, and paliperidone were considered relatively friendlier to patients with the cardiovascular, concerns. Those for whom we are worried about prolactin elevation, there's quite a few of them. Well, we had a few more choices here. Aripiprazole, lisinopril, iloperidone, lurasidone, olanzapine, quetiapine, and ziprasidone. 7 options, actually. When we wanted to avoid excessive sedation in those patients who have this as a big concern, we turned to the less sedating agents, aripiprazole, iloperidone, paliperidone, or ziprasidone. And those at high risk for drug-induced Parkinsonism or akathisia, we had only 2 options in the old days, iloperidone and quetiapine. I mention this in this manner because what happens if you have 2 things going on? You have cardiovascular issues and concerns about prolactin, or you need to avoid sedation and avoid prolactin elevation, or you need to avoid sedation and avoid EPS, acute EPS, or cardiovascular issues and the need to avoid acute EPS. Well, our limitations suddenly kind of grow narrower. And for the actual combination of having concerns over cardiovascular liability and the high risk for drug-induced Parkinsonism, actually no options, none, until now. We now have actually 3 newer second-generation antipsychotics, brexpiprazole and cariprazine, which have been around for a little while, lumateperone since 2019, allowing us to actually address some of these unmet needs in people who have more complex comorbidities or propensities for adverse events. So that's the good news. Newer agents may afford us more opportunities to treat that are better tolerated. So I'm all for having more options. I don't think we have too many second-generation antipsychotics because no second-generation antipsychotic is perfect. And I need to find the right drug for the right person, the right key to the right lock that would be best tolerated. Now, there's another option I want to talk about, kind of brand new, and I call this slide, Let's Make Olanzapine Great Again, MOGA, Make Olanzapine Great Again. So I usually get a few more chuckles than this, but all right. This is a possibility here to use this combination of olanzapine samidorphan. Samidorphan is an opioid antagonist that will mitigate against some of the weight gain that is routinely encountered in the use of olanzapine. Now, mind you, I've never stopped using olanzapine. However, I was like mindful about some people gaining weight. Not everyone gains the weight that you're really worried about, but some do. And I like actually having a choice where this risk is a bit less enough that, you know, I play the odds, I'm going to probably encounter it less often. Now, simidorphan has high affinity principally to the mu opioid receptor as an antagonist, and that seems to be how it works. The mitigation against weight gain occurs after a period of time. It's not immediate. So it is really a maintenance treatment that we can consider. The company has already established that it works acutely, so you can use it acutely. But really, this is a maintenance treatment where you would hope that you would mitigate against some of the weight gain. So it was approved by the FDA this year for the treatment of schizophrenia in adults, as well as bipolar 1 disorder in adults, both as a monotherapy and as an adjunct to lithium or valproate. You cannot give it to people using opioids or patients undergoing acute opioid withdrawal because samidorphan is an opioid receptor antagonist. There are four strengths of this drug. All of them contain the same amount of samidorphan, but differ in the amount of the olanzapine component, 5, 10, 15, or 20. There are some drug-drug interactions. One of them is very familiar to us, the CYP1A2 inhibitor question, that if present, we're going to reduce the amount of olanzapine in what we prescribe. In people who smoke cigarettes, the polyaromatic compounds in the cigarette smoke will induce CYP1A2 and we'll need to give a higher dose. Nonetheless, olanzapine samidorphan will now perhaps address some of the perhaps olanzapine hesitancy that we sometimes see. Maybe that's too loaded a term to use, but hey, I use it anyway. All right, so those are the new solutions for side effects with an emphasis on what's new. What about adherence? Adherence is something that we all deal with in our patients and in ourselves. Anyone here with a chronic illness has an issue with adherence. We're not perfect. How many here have high blood pressure? I know how many hands should go up. I know my epidemiology, and you're not all admitting to it. And you travel to this conference with a pill box, I assume, and you're going to find extra pills in those pill boxes, and you wonder how they got in there. Well, obviously, we are forgetful. Our patients with schizophrenia are also forgetful. They're cognitively impaired. They have chaotic living situations. They need all the help they can get regarding adherence. And unfortunately, we don't think of this often enough. We kind of think when treatments fail that we perhaps made the wrong diagnosis and gave the incorrect treatment. Perhaps we gave the wrong dose of the right medicine. Perhaps we didn't wait long enough. Perhaps they are treatment resistant, when in fact, they're non-adherent. Medication adherence is poor across almost all chronic physical and psychiatric disorders. And just as a benchmark, about 3/4 of people with schizophrenia become non-adherent within 2 years of hospital discharge. That's an old study, but you know, it's still current today. This is an issue. We overestimate adherence because we don't like to admit to ourselves that we may have failed or that our patients are somehow failures. So there's a consistent bias for us to overestimate this, and we'll assume treatment resistance when it's not treatment resistance. This is a possible explanation as to why some of our patients are on a lot of different medicines and perhaps combinations that don't make any sense. This is a no-win cycle because we know adherence is even more of a challenge with complex regimens. The new guidance for dealing with treatment resistance, the TRIP guidelines, actually tell us before we declare someone as treatment resistant, we need to consider a trial, an N-of-1 trial with our patient with a long-acting injectable, just to be absolutely sure. So poor adherence to antipsychotic medication is common and exists in your practice, and poor adherence will drive poor outcomes. That's a fact. So we need to have various ways of dealing with this. The next step of dealing with this is to figure out why is the patient non-adherent or partially adherent. Maybe it's because they will not. They don't see the value in the medicine. They have not bought into it. And so we can think of different ways of addressing this with our patients. Motivational interviewing is something that we can consider. I wish we can spend more time talking about it. It is very impactful. And I urge you to, if you aren't currently practicing motivational interviewing, that you find out more about it. Most of our patients, though, are sitting in our office and agreeable somewhat to take their medicine, except they just can't do it. Either cognition is an issue, disorganization is an issue, their living situation is an issue. We'll try to help them with pill boxes and locations that they can remember to look for, self-monitoring tools, alarms on phones, routines. But we should also consider long-acting injectable medication. I'm a big fan of LAIs. I think they're not offered nearly enough. And if there was a LAI of an antihypertensive back when I was taking antihypertensives, I would have wanted to know about it. My life would have been made easier. Now, I got off LAIs by losing some weight, much to my surprise that my blood pressure went back to normal. My internist didn't think it was possible that that would happen. I proved her wrong. Happy about that. LAI options in the U.S. include first-generation antipsychotics that are all based in sesame seed oil, and then second-generation antipsychotics and all the IM preparations are water-based. We basically have three families, though, and that's it. I wish there was more, but this is what we have. We have the risperidone or paliperidone-containing compounds. We have the aripiprazole-containing formulations, and then we have a stepchild here, olanzapine pamoate, and maybe in the future there'll be an alternate formulation containing olanzapine that we can inject that does not require a 3-hour observation period after each injection. So I'll be happy to address more about that, but I really won't spend much time talking about it. I'll spend my time talking about really the amenities of care with things that we have that we can use every day without much fuss. So the risperidone or paliperidone-containing compounds and the aripiprazole-containing formulations differ in their amenities of care. How often do we inject? What's the size of the needle? How much are we injecting? Is there a choice where we inject? Does the product require reconstitution? Is oral supplementation required? Do we have to put this in a refrigerator? You know, not just any refrigerator where we keep our lunch, in a special refrigerator. That's a nuisance, but we've done it. Are there any special requirements for post-injection observation like there is for olanzapine pamoate and for none of the others? Are there important drug-drug interactions and can they be remedied in some way? What about missed doses? What's the grace period before we have to start all over again with the initiation? Is reimbursement going to be an issue, a problem, if I use this off-label? And in case of reimbursement obstacles, how friendly and easy it is to access the patient assistance program. So these are the amenities of care. It has nothing to do with the molecule, but it has to do everything with ease of use. So I'm going to show you a bunch of slides here that I don't intend to read to you that are available for you to download. And they are summarizing the amenities of care for the two families here, risperidone or paliperidone first, and then aripiprazole next. So we have risperidone subcutaneous in the form of Perseris. We have risperidone microspheres, I'm going to say another brand name, Risperdal Consta. We have paliperidone palmitate monthly, which is we know as Invega Sustenna. And then we have paliperidone palmitate every 3 months, which we know as Invega Trinza. They differ in the amenities of care. Their indications differ in some ways. Where you inject it can differ. The size of the needle differs, the injection volume, and the injection interval. The starting dose and maintenance dose, different strategies. Oral supplementation, different strategies. Refrigeration, different strategies. We also have now an every 6-month preparation known as Invega Half-Yera, very cleverly named. And IS-2 is different in the amenities of care. I mean, really different. And we have coming up in the not-too-distant future, TV 46,000. No, not a name yet, but there's a bunch of posters I urge you to take a look at in the poster hall. This was submitted to the FDA. We'll hear more about it. It's another subcutaneous formulation of risperidone every 4 or 8 weeks. Kind of interesting. You can also inject it in places other than the abdomen. So we have some choices, we'll have more choices. Now, aripiprazole containing formulations, we know them as Abilify Maintena and Aristada, Aristada Initio. Those are the brand names. Their indications can differ, and they do differ. Where you inject it can differ. The size of the needle differs. The injection interval differs. The time that you have before you have to restart the initiation process differs. Different amenities of care. So now let's talk about patches. You wonder why I'm showing you a postage stamp. I'm a philatelist. That's a stamp collector, in case you're wondering. That's what it means. A philatelist is a collector of stamps. The Holman Liver Pad Company is an interesting entity that existed around the era of the Civil War and thereafter. And they had this patent medicine, something that you strap on. So this is Dr. Holman. That's him on the tax stamp. This is the first transdermal that I can find in the modern era. And he wore this system affixed to his torso with straps and a belt. And there he is, like half naked and on a stamp. This is mind-boggling. Anyway, I got this published in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry as a figure. So I think I deserve credit for that. And it talks about this review article, which is free to access, talks about transdermals in psychiatry, what we have and where we're going. And basically, we now have today an acetabine transdermal patch. Compared to sublingual administration, it's once a day, you have consistent plasma concentration, and there's no risk of a bad taste or oral numbing of the mouth, unless you put it in your mouth, but that's not an approved site of application. So you wouldn't do that. No food or drink restrictions. And you can stop administration by just removing the patch. Hey, this is really an interesting, different option. Now, full disclosure, I was involved in the development of this agent. This company that makes it was my first client when I went independent as a consultant in the design and interpretation of clinical trials. By the way, I still continue to see patients. If you're wondering about that, I go to my office one or two times a week, and I see mainly assessments. And I also serve as a voluntary consultant to our Mental Health Association's ACT team. So I'm still out there dealing with patients who need all sorts of different options, be it a different oral medicine, an injection, and now possibly a patch. Now, this patch actually works, decreases the positive negative syndrome scale total score in the pivotal trial that was done to get FDA approval. I have a poster in the poster hall regarding its potential effects in terms of hostility, which you wouldn't think it would have any effect on hostility. It's a patch. You don't have a high peak plasma level. It's just, you know, an even absorption. But yet, take a look at the poster. I'd be happy to talk more about that with you. So let me summarize here. Agents that directly target dopamine and serotonin 5-HT2A receptors are effective for treating psychosis, and we have them today. So we can target both of these receptors within the guise of second-generation antipsychotics with serotonin 5-HT2A only in terms of pimavanserin for Parkinson's disease psychosis. So we have that now. New agents are on the horizon that indirectly target dopamine and glutamate. So these include CEP363856, ulotaront, xanomeline, trospium combination, NBI-425809. Different roads can be taken to get us to where we need to go. Now, we also reviewed medication side effects. They significantly contribute to non-adherence. So we spent a lot of time trying to think of something that works well enough, is tolerable well enough, and that the patient is willing to take. So we'll take into consideration, actually, patient risk factors for specific adverse effects and help them on an individual basis avoid some of the things they experienced in the past. And we have multiple options now in terms of formulations. Molecules and formulations currently exist to help mitigate adverse event risk and enhance adherence. I'm going to stop here with a parting quote. One of my favorite quotes. This is from Winston Churchill in the dark days of November 1942. The Battle of Britain was almost over, and he addresses the country. This is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. This is where we are in the treatment of schizophrenia. So I've adapted these words to sort of put this into perspective.